there's been a little confusion on the starting time here. Some days we start at 1:15 because of caucuses, so that's our excuse for the day. We will open today with a work session on Senate Bill 131. Council.
Thank you, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. Senate Bill 131 arises out of the Restitution Reform Task Force. ORS 137.106, subsection 4, allows the court to establish a restitution payment schedule for an adult criminal defendant or to delegate this responsibility to an appropriate supervising authority. ORS 419C.450 provides the same authority in regard to juvenile offenders and restitution. Presently, this term that the statutes use, quote, appropriate supervising authority, unquote, is undefined. This omission has created some confusion over what specific agencies may create or modify a defendant's payment plan. Senate Bill 131 addresses this confusion by defining appropriate supervising authority as any state or local agency that is authorized to supervise the defendant. And there is a -1 amendment that specifies that such supervising authorities are authorized to modify restitution payment schedules, but not to collect restitution payments.
Okay, committee, we had a hearing on this some time ago. There were problems with some of the bills, but this one seemed to not draw concerns. Don't talk toward me, Senator Walker. I gave away my pseudoephedrine.
You can't get mine.
Okay. So are there any questions of council before we...
I'm ready to make a motion, Madam Chair, just with one clarifying statement.
Okay, Senator Beyer.
When we talked about this bill last time, we talked about deleting a certain phrase, and we did that pretty close. As long as the two twos mean the same thing, there's a two at the start of the line and a two at the end of the line, and we had talked about leaving the first two and deleting the second one, and council did the opposite.
I think it's okay, though.
As long as the two twos, as long as the definition of is still the same as it is.
Let's not get political, Senator Beyer.
I moved the dashboard amendment. Bill. I'm sure.
Okay, Senator Beyer has moved the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 131. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I move the bill as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved Senate Bill 131 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Beyer, would you like to carry this bill to make sure that the legislative history is clear on the two issues?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
And tell Senator Walker I still have pseudoephedrine at home if she needs some.
Okay. I only have a half a box left. I might have to come after that.
Okay. Now we will open a work session on change councils here on Senate Bill 306. Council Kelmans.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 306 concerns motions to reinstate a terminated spousal support obligation. Mm-hmm. When this committee first heard SB 306, it had two concerns. One was the use of the for example in the act, and the second one was a statutory reference on line 30 on page 1 of the bill. And I have checked with legislative counsel, and they've told us that there are numerous statutes that use the for example type language in there. So that was left in, and the statutory reference was since changed. So the only amendments by the -1s are changing the ORS 107.135, which is on line 30 of the original bill, to 107.136. But I think they say this section, which is what Senate Bill 306 is amending.
Council, before you go there, I have 109.13.
The amendment is not correct, Madam Chair.
Does the amendment say 109? Yeah, it says 109, so I didn't catch that before. So.
Oh, when it's deleting, it says 109.
All right. Is that a 109 in the bill?
Okay, well, we're going to have to bring it back then.
Yeah, we'll close it.
Would you like to conceptually amend the amendment?
No, we don't do that except toward the end.
Shoot, it's fun,
well,
though.
This is very straightforward. Let's just have it done right and bring it back. Close this work session on Senate Bill 306. And we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 121. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 121 establishes a fluid recovery system for class actions under the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure. The bill permits the Attorney General to intervene in class actions on behalf of class members who fail to submit a claim form requesting relief from the court. The bill requires a court to include in the judgment a money award to the Attorney General for the amount attributable to the claims of absent class members. It requires the Attorney General to deposit such funds into the Common School Fund.
Okay, thank you. We have signed up Fred Boss from DOJ.
Madam Chair, could I ask a question?
Certainly.
Did we hear this before last session?
We certainly did.
Can I have the bill number so I can look in my note files?
It was, maybe Mr. Boss could tell us.
Okay, because this sounds really familiar.
This bill, as I recall, went through Judiciary Committee, was voted out of committee and experienced constitutional problems and was brought back to Judiciary Committee where it rested peacefully for the remainder of the session. Mr. Boss.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Fred Boss, and I am Chief Counsel of the Civil Enforcement Division of the Oregon Department of Justice. Chair Burdick, you recited the history correctly. It was Senate Bill 216.
Okay, thank you.
216?
216.
Okay.
And it was the A engrossed version that passed out of this committee, went to the floor, and then was referred back to this committee, and then rested in peace. And here I am again.
Now I just need to, Madam Chair, find out what happened to all those boxes of note files I gave to Legislative Administration. Okay, thank you.
Chair Burdick, I am here to testify in support of Senate Bill 121.
Did you identify yourself, Fred? I think
yes,
you
I did, but I will again. My name is Fred Boss, and I am with the Oregon Department of Justice. The issue that Senate Bill 121 addresses is that under the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure, which is ORCP 32F, in a class action where the defendant has been found liable and has been ordered to pay a certain amount of money, the individual class members are required to submit individual claims. Historically, the response of class members is less than 50%. The remaining money is returned to the liable defendant. This becomes a windfall for that defendant. Senate Bill 121 amends ORCP 32F2 and gives the Attorney General the specific authority to intervene to file a claim for the unclaimed funds and to distribute the funds to the Common School Fund. We came before this committee last session with this bill, and we have recited the unfortunate history. One issue that is different from last time is that the Oregon Council on Court Proceedings has recently proposed an amendment to ORCP 32. It is attached to my written testimony. This amendment would allow a distribution to class members whose names, addresses, and amounts of damages are ascertainable. While this amendment is admirable, we believe it does not go far enough. The issue of what to do with the remainder of the funds is not addressed by the Oregon on Council Court Proceedings amendments. These, as proposed under Senate Bill 121, the remainder or the residue should, rather than going back to the tortfeasor, should be sent to the, as we proposed, to the Common School Fund. This type of recovery, not exactly going to the Common School Fund, but to allow a similar type of recovery, is generally allowed by the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure and 36 states which have adopted the federal rules. Other states, such as California and Iowa, have specific laws that allow the recovery to go generally to other like type of funds. In our research, Oregon and New Hampshire are the only states which allow the unclaimed damages to be returned to the tortfeasor. This would only be applicable to cases who actually go to trial and a judgment is entered, and not to settlements. I urge you to pass Senate Bill 121.
Now, the money we're talking about here is after attorney's fees have been paid. Is that correct?
Correct. After court awarded, Chair Burdick, correct. After court awarded attorney's fees have been paid.
And after people who get those coupons in the mail or form to file these claims, after they've been paid off, this is the money that's left over.
Chair Burdick, that's correct.
Okay. Questions from the committee? Senator Cruz.
Yeah, I guess a couple questions, Madam Chair. First of all, I'm having trouble getting my hands around the concept of a judgment is entered, the claims are paid, and what's left goes back to the entity. Since that was their money to start with, how could that be a windfall?
Chair Burdick, Senator Cruz. The entity that is the tortfeasor is found liable for a certain amount of money, and then the people who have been affected are instructed or given notice to submit claims. Historically, because of either like the small amount, it's $1.95 that the people are allowed to are awarded. Or the notice doesn't get out to people adequately. But historically, there's a low rate of people making these claims. The tortfeasor has been adjudicated for X amount of damages. It's just there haven't been people who have submitted claims for the full total amount. So there is a difference between what is awarded and then that portion that has been claimed.
And the reason for having the claims, and correct me if I'm wrong, is because in many cases the person who has been who gets the award has to establish that they own, for example, the security at the time that the, like, I got one for WorldCom, where obviously there was malfeasance. And so the person has to be able to say, document how long they had the security in this case and how many of them they had, because that determines the size of the award. But the award has, the court has made the award based on an assessment of damage to people.
Yeah. Follow-up?
Follow-up.
Yeah, I understand the process here. I guess my problem was money that starts out as mine and then comes back to me is not a windfall. It was mine to start with. But the other question would be...
Wait. What were you calling a windfall?
Well, it was pointed out that those claims that aren't... that the amount of the judgment that isn't claimed goes back to the place it started. So I'm saying if I'm Corporation X... Mm-hmm. And I put forth this money and some comes back to me, it was mine to start with, so I'm not sure how it's a windfall. But that's kind of ancillary to this. And I guess my real question is, how in the world, and let's take some of the drug lawsuits where, and I can't think of a drug off the top of my head right now that is class action.
Huh?
Vioxx, for example. Okay, that's a good one. Thank you, Senator Walker. How do you determine who all the members of the class are? You know, because that determination has to be made, I guess, at some point in time.
Chair Burdick, Senator Cruz, that determination... that determination is made in a process in the class actions prior to the time of the award. So there are hearings to determine whether or not there are sufficient class and a type of class together before they're even allowed to proceed forward as a class action.
Well, I guess I'm sure. you know, something like Vioxx clearly isn't Oregon-specific. And so, I mean, let's take that as an example. Or how do you find out how many people in Oregon, A, took the drug, and how many people that took the drug may have an adverse effect so you can determine the size of the class?
That is part of the Chair Burdick, Senator Cruz. That is part of the litigation prior to the time of the award. That's really not what we're focusing on here. But they form a type of a class. They give notice to individuals that the companies often will provide information. They will publish the information and use all those type of methods to get the word out.
It's a case of someone has, like, someone gets sued and they are owed, forget who it's owed to. Let's say you got a traffic ticket and you owe $100 for speeding. Mm-hmm. But in the class action suit, somebody actually has to make a claim on that money. So the question is, where does the unclaimed money go? Does it go back to you, the speeder, or does it go to someone else? And would you address for a second the properties of the unclaimed property fund? Because as I understand it, and actually have experienced, there's no statute of limitations on making claims from that fund.
Sure, Bertie, that is my understanding. It is our intention to send this to the Department of State Lands that administers the unclaimed property fund as part of the Common School Fund. The interest goes to the Common School Fund, and then there's established procedure for making claims against that particular fund.
Not the Treasury.
So if you could put it anywhere you want, the money, but the value of putting it in the unclaimed property fund is that there's no statute. If you find your coupon 20 years later and want your part of the class action so that you can still make a claim. That was the rationale for putting it there. Plus, it's a good cause.
Chibberick, yes, it does benefit the Oregon schools.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair?
Senator Barr.
If Senator Cruz is done. A couple questions. I guess, first, if someone thinks they've been harmed, don't you think they'd be sending a coupon in?
Senator Beyer, many do, others because of the small amount, because it gets lost in the mail, they don't adequately receive the notice, they don't send it in.
Or maybe because they don't think they've been harmed. Another question, Madam Chair.
Please.
Isn't the purpose of the unclaimed property fund, isn't their mission, their purpose, to try to reunite people with their property?
Chair Burdick, Senator Beyer, yes.
So in this case, we have no idea who these people are, how they lost the money. How are you going to notify them so they can let them know that they got this unclaimed property there?
Chair Burdick, Senator Beyer, they may discover over time. I know that the Department of State Lands or whoever has custody of this, to the best of their ability, try to notify people, but it could be very difficult here.
Another question, Madam Chair.
Please.
Under the ORCP 32, the rule that you provided to us with your testimony, if that method is used, where if you find the name and address of these people and you would require the people to be sent a check, if those people who received the check, if they never cashed the check, what happens to the money?
Chair Burdick, Senator Beyer, I believe goes into the unclaimed property account.
That's true of any check, isn't that correct?
Chair Burdick, that is correct.
Senator Beyer, I got recently a paycheck from a client that was issued 15 years ago, and I had just happened to look on the unclaimed property thing, and sure enough, they got hold of it. Any other questions? Thank you. Thank you. Okay, Tim Martinez and Ken Sherman.
Yeah. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. I'm joined today, to my right, Ken Sherman, longtime counsel for the Oregon Bankers Association. As the chair stated, this is an issue that's been around for a couple of sessions now. I know it's a huge interest to the chair, but it is one that the Oregon Bankers Association continues to oppose. We have spent several years, frankly since they started the Council on Court Procedures, dealing with various issues like this. We are very pleased, though, that this last interim, they made it clear that this was an issue for you to resolve. So that's one of the reasons this is back here for you. This is not simply a procedural matter. This is a change in policy, and as such should be before you. So we appreciate that it is before you, and thank the council for their efforts in the interim and not going beyond what they should do policy-wise. Having said that, Ken Sherman was part of the work group that dealt with this issue in the interim. I'd like him to make some remarks. I would just respond briefly, if I could, to some of the things that were said by the proponents. We have not heard, because we've talked about this issue again in the Council on Court Procedures for several years, we haven't heard anything to suggest that the notice is not getting out there adequately, which I believe the Attorney General's office has said. Obviously, you are going to have a very small percentage of mail that occasionally gets missent, but we have not heard of anything that really falls along the line that the mail is, the claim forms are not getting to the appropriate parties. I think Senator Beyer was pretty accurate in his comment that sometimes you look at these things and you try to decide, is it worth it to send back for $1.95? And you know, were you really harmed for $1.95? So that is a big issue. We also believe, and I don't know if Mr. Sherman will address in his comments, that if you do go down this road, you are looking at perhaps really increasing the plaintiff's attorney fees here as opposed to getting out to the claimant themselves. I think your analogy, Madam Chair, on the speeding ticket's a good idea. I haven't had one for a few years, but the last time I did, I got it reduced a few dollars. And wouldn't it be nice if somebody would have paid that extra money to the Common School Fund to help our kids rather than getting me off the hook? So I think it's kind of a similar argument here.
You're twisting my words, Mr. Martinez.
Madam Chair, I don't mean to, certainly. I also think, in response to some of the comments made by the committee, it might be helpful to bring in the Department of State Lands and talk about this. We're working with them on the House side on a completely separate bill, but dealing with unclaimed property, and they really have a neat program. But it is, as I think Senator Beyer stated, it is designed to reunite people with their unclaimed property, as they did with you. It's not for a case like this where they don't even know these folks exist. So with that, I would encourage the committee to go slow again. You recited accurately the history from last session, and I would be happy to answer any questions now or turn it over to Mr. Sherman for his comments.
Maybe Mr. Sherman's going to address this, but I guess I'm just wondering why banks would be particularly affected by this bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we didn't look at it that way a couple of years ago. I've had some email and some conversations with folks, and I understand from a previous employee of the Attorney General's office that when they did a run on this about what happened in the last 10 years, every instance was indeed a bank case. One of them went all the way back to Ben Franklin, which was a huge class action here in Oregon several years ago. I talked to that particular employee who now does the Capital Club book and other things, and his comments were that a lot of the other groups that are find themselves in class action situations a lot of times will settle. And I think the Attorney General's office made it very clear that in those cases where there's a settlement, this bill would not apply. For some reason, my clients must be very stubborn and really want their day in court, because it seems like they're not settling as often and are actually going through the whole court process. And I guess I would argue that under this bill, they would potentially be punished for going and having their day in court rather than settling before the trial.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chairman Burdick and members of the committee. I'm Ken Sherman. I'm counsel for the Oregon Bankers Association. And I think you've received copies of my testimony. I will tell you up front that in consideration of your busy schedule, what I have to say is not everything that is on that those pages, so I hope you'll take the time at your convenience to read through our more extensive comments. Before I get into my prepared remarks, I want to just address one thing that the proponent of the bill said that I think is not quite accurate. At least if I understood him correctly, Mr. Boss said that in a class action, when it's been determined that the defendant is liable, that the court enters a judgment, and then claim forms are sent out, and then people send them back, and only those people, only that part of the judgment represented by those claims forms is actually paid out. Well, that's not quite how it works. If you look at ORCP 32F, it provides very specifically, and this is a section that would be changed by this bill, but I'm talking now about current law. It says that the amount of the judgment is determined only after the claim forms have come back in. So it's not as though we have a pot of money sitting there. A class action is nothing more than an accumulation of many small claims against a defendant, and you determine first the liability of the defendant, and then you determine the amount of damages caused by that, and the means that we, by which we do that under the current law, is through this claim form process, where members of the plaintiff class are sent these forms, they fill them back in, and the rule now says very clearly that the amount of judgment entered by the court will not exceed the total of all the claim forms that are submitted. So we're talking about a very substantial change in the law and a very substantial change in the amount of judgment of the judgment that would be entered by the court in that situation. I did work as a member of, kind of an outside member, I guess, of the work group that was put together, I think about a year ago, to address the provisions of ORCP 32F, and specifically to focus on the claim form, which has been a part of our class action rules for as long as I've been practicing. I think it is fair to characterize our class action rules here in Oregon as the product of compromise that has occurred over the years between the defense bar and the plaintiff's bar, and I think that compromise has generally served us well. But coming out of the last session of the legislature, there was a desire to look again at the claim form, and this work group spent several meetings going through the claim form and trying to determine how to make it work better. And they did some, I think, important things to improve the claim form. They provided for it to be a more user-friendly form, for instance, to make it available in Braille or in second languages in appropriate cases. So they made those kinds of improvements, and they also had quite a discussion, and this really became the focus of the work group, on the so-called exclusion model versus the inclusion model. Right now, or historically, the rule has said that that you send these claim forms out to the members of the plaintiff class, and as I said before, then you simply receive those back in and you add them up, and that's the amount of your judgment. That's the inclusion rule. The exclusion rule, which the council eventually adopted over our objections, but it's a democratic process, basically says that you send the form out in these cases where you're able to identify who the members of the plaintiff class are and the amount of damages that they've suffered. You send a form out that says, we find that you're a member of this class and you've been damaged in this amount. If you do nothing, then we're going to include you and you will receive your damages in due course. If you don't want to be included, then send something back into us and tell us that. So that's the rule that came out of the Council on Court Procedures last fall. And One of the concerns that I have, frankly, about this bill, that council worked very diligently and through a lot of difficult processes to get to that compromise, and this would basically throw all of that out, all of those improvements that were made in the claim form and the moving to the exclusion form as opposed to what we have now. All of that would go by the wayside and be replaced by this bill. So that was one of the primary concerns that I had when I saw this bill.
Oh, before you leave that point, that Council on Court Procedures rule only applies to cases where the people can be identified, readily identified. So they send them, they assume that they're included, and they send them the judgment. And then they have to take action to be excluded. I don't see how this would affect that in any way. This only pertains to people who can't be readily identified, as I understand the court. If it doesn't, then that's definitely what it should do.
Well, I think that is not correct, Chairman Burdick. I believe that the change that would be made by Senate Bill, are you talking about the change made by Senate Bill 121? I think that would apply to all class actions. You can have, let's say that you have a group of plaintiffs that we can identify. Let's assume for the moment that they're bank customers. We know who all the bank customers are from the bank's records. So we can identify that group. So you send the notice out to that finite group of people, and you say, we've determined the true damages are X. Only 50%, in Mr. Boss's example, respond to that and say, I want my 50%. That's what the current rule would be under this bill. Then the AG could come in with respect to the other 50% who didn't respond. So there you've got an identified class of plaintiffs, and yet this bill would apply. And if I'm misreading the bill, then I need
well,
I stand.
Maybe correct. it's my misunderstanding, but it, when you said that the judgment, the amount of the judgment is based on people who return their forms, that is not what I thought was the case. I thought the judgment was an amount that people file claims against.
Chair Burdick, that's not correct under the current law. The current law says specifically, and in fact I even brought that language, if you'll give me just a minute, I'll find it. Well, if you look at the most, I'm not sure you have ORCP 32 available to you mm-hmm. up there, but mm-hmm. subsection F, Roman numeral 4, says the amount of damages assessed against the defendant shall not exceed the total amount of damages determined to be allowable by the court for all individual class members. So that language is, that's not changed. That's part of the existing ORCP 32F.
Okay, so go ahead and continue, pardon the interruption.
Okay, thank you. So just to bring to a conclusion my comments with regard to the intersection between the work of the council and this bill, it seems to me that this bill will undo the good work of the council that came through that process over the last year. And I think, regardless of your perspective, that's something that you should not take lightly. You have empowered the council to make these rules, and I think that their considerations should be very much in your mind as you move forward. And rather than just wholesale throwing those out, if you're going to move forward with this kind of a bill, I think there should be an effort to integrate the two concerns.
Can I ask a question here?
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Sherman. The council can't enact these changes without legislative approval, correct?
Chair Burdick, Senator Walker, the way I understand the Council on Court Procedure process, they go through this process of coming up with rule changes,
right.
And they present them to the legislature at the beginning of the session, and then they go into effect unless the legislature changes them. And my concern is that this bill does not include any of the changes that were made. If this bill is enacted, it will take Rule 32F right back to where it was a year ago.
Okay, so currently, if I could follow up, Madam Chair, Rule 32F has been changed according to the Council on Core Procedures. Mm-hmm. If we didn't do anything, that would take effect at the end of this legislative session without any legislative action. But if we pass Senate Bill 121 as it is written today, it would wipe out all of the change that they had proposed, is what you're saying.
Thank you for saying it much more clearly than I did.
Okay, great. Well, my head's a little plugged up today, so I'm just having to restate things. But that makes sense. Thank you.
But it would also be, rule change only applies in cases where the amount of the damage and the people who have been damaged can be identified. I think what 121, and you do raise a very good point, that right now it probably is, as you say, that it would obviate that rule, and I don't think that's the intention of the legislation. Certainly not my intention. I think what this gets at is people who where there are larger, more complex cases where not everyone has the same amount of damage in the class, where you have a situation where some kind of documentation or some kind of extra step is required. It's not just people who, you know, had some aspirin. You know, it's not like a consumer product case where you can just, where the court lets you just apportion the $1.92 for each, you know, person who's been damaged. I think this is intended for the larger, more complex cases.
Chair Burdick, I agree with that. I think that's true. The other major concern that we have with this bill is just that we see it as kind of taking the whole process of class actions in a direction that was never really anticipated historically, and that we should think carefully about going in that direction. Class actions are a procedural tool that are used to determine the rights and the remedies of large numbers of people who have cases that involve common questions of law and fact. And most of the beginning parts of Rule 32 are setting out some very elaborate rules about when you can do something as a class action versus a series of individual actions. Class actions also provide for equitable division of damages when defendants' funds are limited, and the first individual claims that might be brought, if they were brought as individual claims, could exhaust the funds that would otherwise belong to other members of the class. Class actions are not intended to punish the defendant to the greatest extent possible. That's not what they were designed to do. They're designed to provide a civil remedy and to provide for economy of court proceedings so that you can hear a bunch of claims that are very similar in one proceeding. Class actions are not intended to be an additional avenue to extract punitive damages that are given back to society. Now, there is, of course, the availability of punitive damages, as, at least in some cases, for the court to award, but that's not really why we invented the class action. It was, again, to provide that economy of court action. Further, not tying the defendant's judgment to the claims actually filed by individuals is inconsistent with the basic principles of civil actions. Under Senate Bill 121, if the Attorney General files a claim on behalf of a potential class member, there is no provision that would allow a potential class member to opt out of the suit, and that's one of the concerns that I have. We've all received these notices, and on more than one occasion, I can remember specifically thinking, that is a nonsense, nuisance claim. I don't believe in it. I don't want to be a part of it. I don't want my name lent to it, and I just throw it away. And I think that to take away from people the right to disassociate themselves from a claim that they don't believe in is fundamentally inconsistent with our general principles. So we have a serious concern about that. In addition, Senate Bill 121 is also inconsistent with the principle of damages in civil law. And civil law damages are intended to compensate for a loss suffered by the plaintiff, and that's the individual member. Damages should put the plaintiff in the position they were in before the defendant violated their rights or caused them harm, or at least put them in as close to that position as is possible. Essentially, the damages are intended to help or repair the plaintiff, not a third party, such as the Common School Fund. The Cypre Doctrine in Senate Bill 121 would disregard this fundamental principle by giving damages intended to compensate a potential class member, the ones who have suffered the loss, to a third party, the state, who the defendant did not harm and who did not suffer a loss. And I think it's even a fact that in those situations with the exclusion rule, if you go with the Attorney General's approach under the new exclusion rule that was adopted by the Council on Court Procedures, as I said, court decides defendant is liable. In those limited cases where you can identify the defendants or the plaintiffs and you can identify the amount of damage, you send out the statement. If I like that, if I want that amount of damages, I need do nothing. I will get a check in the mail. But if I do nothing and you've adopted this bill and you've thrown out that exclusion rule that was adopted by the council, now the Attorney General in the state of Oregon get my money. So you're actually going counter to the interests of the individual plaintiff in that kind of a case. We don't, as a matter of conclusion, think this bill is very well thought out. Class actions, I discovered, and I'm not a class action litigator by any stretch of the imagination, but I discovered as a part of this work group that it's a very complex area of the law. I learned a great deal from my colleagues on the work group, and I think that at the very least there are some fundamental questions of civil fairness that are raised by this bill, and that at least it is appropriate to go back and try and meld the concepts that were developed by the Council on Court Procedures with the principles that are brought forward in this bill. Thank you very much for your time. I'll be happy to answer any
questions.
Thank you.
And you're right. This is a very complex area of the law, and certainly not my intent to try to replace a good option that went as far as the court of the Council on Court Procedures was able to go. So, are there questions from the committee?
Yeah, I have one.
Senator Walker.
Thank you. I'm a little bit confused because State Farm is my insurance carrier. I think John Powell's left the room, so I could probably talk about it now. But State Farm, some time back, had a class action filed against it. For take me back, they when people had their cars wrecked and had them taken into shops to get them fixed, the allegation was that State Farm was using parts that weren't up to snuff and not telling the owner about that. So then there was a class action against it, against State Farm, and I got sent a notice. And I saw it published in Parade magazine and elsewhere that I could become part of the class. But they already had told me as part of the class what I would get out of it. And it was nothing that I was going to bother to fill out all the stupid paperwork for. So I chose not to be a part of the class. But you're saying that the class, the judgment's not determined until you get the class people to return their ballot. So why is it in some instances you already know what the judgment is and in others you don't? And Mr. Martinez wrote you a note. So.
Well, he's right. Chair Burdick, Senator Walker, it's very possible that that case was filed in a jurisdiction other than Oregon.
It was a federal jurisdiction.
Okay. So we have different rules for the federal jurisdiction than we do for the state.
Gotcha.
And that's why that
I
happened.
I should have known that.
Well, but that does raise the question of, you know, how, because I, you know, you can see where the language is deleted, limiting them to the amount of the claims that are filed.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to bring Mr. Boss back up here in a minute and ask about how that would change how judgments are structured.
I can add.
Counsel, please.
Thank you. So there's two times when notices are typically sent out in class actions. One is during the opt-out period, when you define what the class is. So at that time, when you're saying, you know, the class is going to be made up of all people who purchased, who had State Farm insurance during this time, for example, and then the defendant typically knows who those people are, not in all cases, but so you provide notice at that point and you come up with sort of a rough guesstimate of how many people are in the class. Once there's a judgment, then you have to sort of get it down to some specificity. So you might have a, when you're thinking about settlement and things like that, you say, well, I know there's about 100,000 people in the class, so my potential liability is whatever. But that's why you might know how big the class is, but you don't know for sure until people send back the sort of F2 notice, which is the judgment notice. So that's why you might get different figures.
And that's how it's the F2 that allows them to get their money.
Right. So then there's been a judgment. Well, there's been a finding of liability. There hasn't been a judgment yet. And then there's another form that goes out to the class and says, okay, you're all entitled to X amount. Or there might be a situation where you need more information from individual consumers. You know, did you buy a muffler? Did you buy, you know, what kind of insurance did you have? And you might have to check certain boxes. So you still don't really know until you get all those forms back. How much money the defendant really owes. So you might have a general idea of the size of the class based on the opt-out period, but until there's been a verdict and the claim forms have gone out, you're not going to know for sure how much money you're talking about. So is that right?
Well, Madam Chair, I was sitting here thinking, in a bankruptcy, when someone files bankruptcy, if you don't file a claim in the case, you don't get paid. So if you're a creditor, you think you're a creditor, you have a certain period of time to file a claim. And if you file a late claim, well, then you might get paid and you might not, depending on whether it's a surplus asset case, which rarely they are. So you make that choice. And then but here's the other thing, which you really don't want to do, is that if you don't file a claim, then that leaves more money for the other creditors. So what I'm seeing here is sort of like that. If we don't have a claim filed, then Cypre would say, well, the money comes in anyway, and we're going to give it to the Common School Fund in this case.
Mm-hmm. But I think one of the issues that's come up is, you know, how is the amount of money determined? And that's what I want to bring Mr. Boss.
Mr. Boss.
Well,
Mr. Boss.
Are there any questions for this witness? Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We have John Powell from State Farm on the record against Senate Bill 21. The records show that in its current form. We have signed up Lisa Tressel. Lisa, and then I'll bring Mr. Boss back up to answer a couple of these questions.
Welcome. Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm Lisa Tressel with Associated Oregon Industries, and I'm here to voice our concerns with Senate Bill 121, and much you've already heard from Mr. Martinez and Mr. Sherman. But particularly it's that how the wards are determined, and so are you going to be paying for people who have opted not to participate, and we've all gotten class action notices that we've either decided yes or chucked it in the garbage or recycled it because we weren't interested in it. And then it would also, if the Attorney General can step in and assume the place for somebody who's choosing not to participate, it does disregard that individual's determination of whether they want to participate or not. So with that, I'll conclude.
Okay, questions? Okay. Mr.
Thank
Boss,
you.
Come on back. Thank you. Okay, my question is on page 3 of the bill where you delete the method of on line 31 through 34 where you delete the methodology for assessing what the damage award is. How would the amount of the pool, if you were, be determined under Senate Bill 121? If you're taking out that methodology of doing it.
Let's see.
Council has actually volunteered to take a shot at this if we can let council.
Thank you, council.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What usually happens is, so you have a verdict of liability, and you know you have the people who have returned the form, so you have a number there. What would have to happen is there'd have to be some sort of finding by the judge as to, or even a factual finding, as to the number of people in the class. It would get confusing when you're talking about individual determinations. In that case, I'm not sure how you would find out exactly the size of the damages. But when it's a relatively easy calculation, all you would need to know are the number of people who purchased a product during a certain time or something like that. And then that just becomes a factual issue like any other factual issue.
Chair Burdick, I agree it would be a presentation just like any other case that where you would present your evidence, your damage, evidence of damages. That Oregon is unique, and that sentence that is being deleted is what makes Oregon unique. The Oregon are the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure and the Rules of Civil Procedure in 36 states are exactly, well, do not have that. They have our rules with that sentence or two deleted.
With what?
In 36 states and in the federal courts, that the rules for class actions has that sentence deleted, that is being deleted.
Okay, so their methodology would be like counsel describes. You do your best estimate of how many people were affected, then on that basis you set the amount of the pool, and then people make claims against it.
Shaberdick, that is my understanding, yes. And like counsel, I'm not a class action attorney, but that's my understanding of how it would work.
Okay, and then if in with that methodology, you said in your testimony that they have some place to put the leftover money that is not the tortfeasor.
Correct. That is, Chair Burdick, that is correct. With the residual money, then it would, rather than going to the tortfeasor, it would go to the, in this case, the Comm School Fund.
Another question I wanted to ask you is about this matter of the of not wanting to get in the way of the council court procedures in places where the class can be identified and the amount of the damages can be apportioned. I wanted to get your read on whether this would replace those regulations, in effect repeal those regulations, or whether this bill and those regulations can be made consistent, or whether this bill could be made to preserve those regulations.
Chair Burdick, it is certainly not the intent of this bill to change those at all, except for those that relate to this particular area of the residue. That was the first time that I heard that a passage of a bill in this area would, in effect, repeal the Council on Court Proceedings rules. And so I would like to investigate that further. Certainly not the intent of this bill to supersede those changes about notification and inclusion in the class.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Questions from the committee?
Just for my edification or edification of other members of the committee, who's on the Council of Court Procedures, and don't we fund their budget just a smidge? We used to do it a lot more.
A mini smidge, Senator Walker.
Yeah, no, it's really pathetic.
Chair Burdick, Senator Walker, it is primarily, as my understanding, is run by the Oregon Judicial Department, and there
is not.
It is not. And my understanding is incorrect.
Okay.
I don't know.
I know. Do we have anybody from the council in the audience? And again, I'm not the expert on it either, but it was actually run through the University of Oregon, kind of oversaw it for years. And it's a defense bar and it's now at Lewis and Clark, and it includes defense bar and plaintiffs bar lawyers, and they basically just do a whole lot of hard work for very little compensation.
They're sort of like the Oregon Law Commission in a way, only on procedural rules that if they weren't in existence, we'd have to be doing them here.
That's exactly right. We actually established, Madam Chair, we actually, meaning the legislature, established the council back in the 80s, if I'm not mistaken.
That's what I thought.
And we actually had a budget note that was attached to their funding this last time that Representative Ackerman and I were the legislators sitting in with a committee looking at how the work is done by the council and the budget and how they're funded. And so we got a pretty good briefing. And it is something that, I mean, you think about it, with all due respect to everyone on this committee, there's only one of us that's actually legally trained, and this is not my area at all. And you think that if we as a legislature is going to take on the task of actually setting civil rules, what that means. And I think our predecessors that from the 70s and 80s realized that it would be better to get people from both sides of the issues, plaintiff's bar, defense bar, the judicial branch, all involved, and let them actually go through the fine details of these type of rules, because this is clearly one of those things, hydraulics. You push one place, you're going to have another impact somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And if we're trying to do that here, we're probably going to be seeing bills coming back each and every session trying to take care of what we really don't understand what we're doing. So I've always valued the part of the council, and you know, that's one of those things that I know that Ways and Means right now is dealing with as to whether they should even fund them. And the alternative is we have these type of hearings day in and day out.
Yeah, and we don't want that. These people do just amazing work as volunteers. They're unpaid. They take time away from their practice, and they really do yeoman's work.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to just get that on the record because I knew some of that history, and I appreciate Senator Prozanski's explanation because they do. And I, for one, am not really interested as a committee member of going over the minutia that they do. So.
Did you have a question?
Well, I was just going to say, you know, it does get complicated, and if it was left up to us, all we'd have to go by is common sense. So this wouldn't work, I'm sure.
Okay, and sometimes even common sense can get you in trouble. So thank you very much. We will close the are there anybody else who wants to talk on this? We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 121. And open a public hearing on $223.68, since we have two signed up for that. Yeah, does it matter? Oh, well, let's do that first. We have a bill on the Council on Court Procedures, House Bill 2367. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2367 provides that the Council on Court Procedures can take action on all matters other than the promulgation of rules after an affirmative vote by a majority of the members who are present at a meeting, so long as a quorum is present. And if you look at the summary, there's a little description of the Council on Court Procedures on the bottom.
Okay, Mustafa Kasubai. You'll tell me what it really is, right?
Chair Burdick, senators and members of the committee, I think we'd have to refer my last name to the Committee on Court Procedures to determine accurate pronunciation.
Okay, say your whole name for the record.
Mustafa Kasubai.
Oh, I see. I think I was right.
You did.
You kind of.
Thank you. As I've just mentioned, my name is Mustafa Kasubai. And I am here on behalf of the Procedures and Practices Committee of the Oregon State Bar in support of House Bill 2367. As the summary indicated, and I actually have not much additional substance to provide, but it is important for the purposes of housekeeping and providing some clear guidelines with respect to the quorum necessary to approve rules. The Procedures and Practices Committee currently under the current statute would have to have a majority of all members of the committee in order to promulgate certain rules. not all of the rules, but for certain rules. What this this amendment accomplishes is that it would allow a majority of the quorum present to be able to conduct business. And it would appear to be a fairly straightforward and safe housekeeping matter to allow the efficiency in conducting business for the Council on Court Procedures, and would recommend a due pass. With that, if there are any other questions.
I think it's a statement of the diligence of the council that this is only coming up now, which means that they have a very high attendance level.
Chair Burdick, that would appear to be correct. I have to admit I have not heard of anyone challenging also this quorum matter, but I think it's an attempt to be proactive as well, to especially if they are going to be involved in the promulgation of civil procedure rules. Mm-hmm. It would appear that they would also want to ensure the integrity of their own house.
Right. And Senator Przanski, as a member of the work group, are you comfortable with this?
Oh, very much. Yeah, I mean, this basically just crosses some T's and dots the I's and makes certain that if it comes down to a need to get a vote out, that they can actually do it based on the quorum, just like any other public body.
Yeah. Okay. Well, any other questions from the committee?
Yeah.
What?
What other matters do they do besides the promulgation of rules?
Uh-huh.
I mean, the obvious.
Chair Burdick, Senator Beyer, it's a darn acute, insightful question, since the very reason for being is to promulgate rules of procedure. And there is a provision in the already existing statute that requires 15 members to vote to adopt rules of procedure. I don't know the actual answer. I can get additional information, but there would be housekeeping rules for conducting business that would be subject to this majority of the quorum rule that we're attempting to correct. And Chair Burdick, Senator Beyer, if you would like, I can obtain additional information to provide that to the committee.
This is, to me, it's like asking that a legislative committee can do anything but pass a bill by a majority of members present if there's a quorum, and we can't. We can't change our rules, our operating rules, by a majority of members present if there's a quorum. We still have to have majority of committee members, and if that's what they're trying to do is change the rules by which the committee works under, that to me is just as important as changing the rules that govern the court.
Are you telling me that they had operated as if this were in effect in the past and nobody's challenged them? Is that one of the things I heard?
Chair Burdick, there hasn't been any instances in which this issue has come up. This is an sort of an anticipatory, proactive measure to ensure that they don't run into this problem in the future.
So you said they have 15 members?
There, 15 members would need to be actually vote for a change to rules of procedure. With respect to the composition of the Council on Court Procedures, there is one Supreme Court Justice, one Court of Appeals Judge, 8 trial judges, and 12 members of the Oregon State Bar.
Plus one public member.
Thank you, Senator Przanski.
Mr. Martinez may have some insight here.
There's 23 total.
If I may, Madam Chair, none of my business colleagues are behind me, right? Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. We actually took a look at this bill, and we'd be happy to help the council in their testimony. What we see would be like minutes of meetings,
right,
that kind of stuff that they don't have, because having been very intimately involved with this group for the last 3 or 4 years, I mean, they sometimes have to go several meetings just to get their minutes approved because they don't have a quorum until it really gets down to those rule promulgating times. So, I don't I understand where Senator Byer's coming from, but this truly is just a housekeeping measure for minutes and other things like that, approval of agendas and stuff like that. So speaking on behalf of the bankers, we would not have any issue with this bill.
Question, Madam Chair?
Senator Byer.
Thank you. Mr. Martinez, do you know if this would allow them to change the rules on how they operate by a majority of members present?
Senator Burdick, Senator Byer, I don't know the answer to that. I do not believe it does. I mean, I'm not going to say yes or no. I do not believe it does. This is simply, you know, they've made it very clear that they cannot, and we would argue that strenuously on rule promulgation, that they cannot do that without the number that's in the statute. And as the gentleman mentioned, that is in statute, the number they need for that. So I appreciate your comments, Senator, but I just don't see this as being any more than a real housekeeping issue.
Yeah, Senator Byron, line 19 and 20 on the first page of the bill, I think that really should answer that question. An affirmative vote of 15 members shall be required to promulgate rules.
But promulgate rules means to promulgate rules on how the courts operate. the question is more on the rule, or maybe they don't have rules on how this council operates.
Yeah, so but the part that you're concerned with is the actual rules that they adopt.
No, the part I'm not concerned about that. That's clearly in statute. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I'm talking about the rules of how they run the council.
And what is your concern?
Well, whether or not this rule would allow them to change those rules by a majority of members present.
But is there any particular rule, like how often they meet, or
I don't know if there are rules on how they operate. That's my question. If there are, does this allow them to change them so that they can do everything but promulgate rules? I don't know. You know, I'm just not familiar with how they operate.
Well, yeah, if I may, Madam Chair. I mean, reading what's in that statute now, it would be for all matters other than promulgating rules. So anything that they do and how they operate would be there, but that's, to me, housekeeping. The bottom line is they can't pass anything that's going to impact the civil rules of procedure without maintaining what's in statute of 15 members voting for that change. And so how they run their meetings, the days they run them, how often they meet. I'm not sure what we would be protecting by not adopting this bill.
Madam Chair, if I may as well, and Senator Byer, if this helps at all, they do have a legislatively approved budget. And in that budget, they have to follow the same as anybody else as far as reimbursements, expenses. It's a volunteer organization outside of mileage, basically. So there really, you know, isn't anything there that we see that they could do under this bill that would take them away from their core mission and still have the same requirements to fulfill that mission.
Madam Chair.
Senator Byer.
How do these 12 lawyers and a member of the public and the eight circuit judges get appointed?
Chair Burdick, Senator Byer, I can speak with respect to the Oregon State Bar members. That they're selected by the Board of Governors of the Oregon State Bar. I do not have an answer with respect to the judicial members.
Well, it says how. Down here? Yeah. Each of them.
One judge chosen by the Supreme Court. I assume the Chief Justice would do that.
Chair Burdick, that would be a perfect example of ensuring that I actually read the entire statute before attempting to answer a question. Thank you.
Okay.
You never know what question you're going to get asked up here.
You know, sometimes the darnest things happen on these housekeeping bills. Anyway, are there other questions from the committee?
If I might, I'm sorry, Chair Burdick, in further response to Senator Byer's concerns, I'd like to offer that one of the rules that they obviously could not change because they are a creature of statutory construction is the composition of the members. So to the extent that there is a level of impartiality or fairness memorialized in the statute, the members themselves could not, by a quorum alone and a majority vote of the quorum alone, change the structure of that level playing field.
In fact, they couldn't do it in any capacity. Yes. The statute dictates how the membership's going to be.
Okay, thank you very much. Well, my comfort level with this bill started out fairly high, and it got higher as we discussed it. So, Senator Byer, all right, we'll close the public close the public hearing on 2367. Senator Byer, do you have a motion?
I'll make the motion. I think about it. We'll see.
I'll make the motion. Make it easy for you.
Okay. Madam Chair. Your choice, Senator Byer.
We heard it in work session.
Yeah, you need to go to work session first, I think.
But. Oh, darn. Okay, open a work session on Senate, on House Bill 2367. Sorry about that.
Madam Chair, I'll move House Bill 2367 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Byer has moved House Bill 2367 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Przanski, would you like to carry this?
No.
Okay, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2368. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2368 establishes that a trial court has jurisdiction to decide a motion for judgment notwithstanding the verdict, a motion for a new trial, or a motion for relief from a judgment, even if a party has already filed a notice of appeal.
Okay. Mr. Kasubai, you're back again.
He's back.
And you have to identify yourself for the record again so I can hear your name one more time. Thank you.
Chair Burdick, senators and members of the committee, my name is Mustafa Kasubi.
It was better the first time. Okay, thank you.
I apologize, Chair. That was a joke.
Oh, a joke.
I wanted to differentiate myself from the first person who testified.
We never joke in this committee. Say it again.
My first name is Mustafa Kasubai, spelled the same way.
But, you know, separating yourself from that other guy may be a good idea.
I thought it might be prudent under the circumstances.
That's pretty funny.
I also am appearing again as a member of the Oregon State Bar Procedures and Practices Committee. I've been a practitioner since 1997 in private practice for most of that time, and more recently appointed by Governor Kulongoski to the Oregon Workers' Compensation Board. In that capacity, I review appellate cases. But today, as I've indicated, am here with respect to my membership on the Procedures and Practices Committee and recommend a due pass with respect to House Bill 2368. If I might indulge Chair Burdick, Mr. Jim Nass from Judicial Department is also present.
Yes, please, Mr. Nass, I apologize. I should have called you up at the same time. Thank you.
It appears that I would do better with somebody bigger next to me. the bill is designed to solve some problems with putting the cart before the horse when it comes to litigation and judgments. As a matter of some background information, this bill addresses the appeal process for when one can appeal and who has jurisdiction of judgments notwithstanding the verdict, motions for a new trial, and motions for relief from a judgment. Now, by way of an example, once a judgment's been entered at a trial, the party has generally 30 days to appeal to the Court of Appeals to preserve those issues and ask for relief from the appellate courts. However, there's also processes by which the losing party, let's say at the trial, can ask for a new trial at the court level, at the trial court level, or ask for a judgment in spite of the jury verdict, and those are addressed in some of the rules of civil procedure. As well, there's another procedure that allows for a party to ask for corrections of clerical mistakes in a judgment. Now, when these motions are filed to the judge at the trial level, the judge has 55 days in order to dispose of the judgment, or it's deemed denied. Now, we run into a problem when, and this is the practical reality where many judges may not get to that disposal of the motion within those 55 days. And in that instance, when that 55 days runs out, the motion for a new trial would be denied or deemed denied. But what happens is that parties can and have become confused about what they do with that 30-day time frame in which to file an appeal to the Court of Appeals. If they don't file that petition to the Court of Appeals within that first 30 days, many people get concerned that they might lose that right to appeal. Unbeknownst to them, the practice has been that the trial court would normally retain jurisdiction for that 55 days while the motion is being considered, after which then the 30 days would begin to run for the party to file an appeal to the Court of Appeals. But once the party files a petition to the Court of Appeals, the trial court loses any jurisdiction to hear any of the motions for a new trial, and then it gets kicked up to the Court of Appeals without having been having opportunity for the court, the trial judge, to rule on any of those motions. So what this bill attempts to do is incorporate into ORS 19270 the recognition that the trial judge retains jurisdiction for motions for new trials, motions notwithstanding the verdict, motions for relief against the judgment, so that it becomes clear for all parties involved that jurisdiction continues with the trial court until the motions have been decided, at which point then people can file a petition to the Court of Appeals. Now, in the event that a petition to the Court of Appeals is filed while the motions are still pending, this change ensures that jurisdiction still rests with the trial judge.
Okay, does this mean that the Court of Appeals can't rule on the motion until the trial judge time period is over?
With respect to those motions, Chair Burdick, yes. If I might also ask if Mr. Nass could offer any more clarification.
Welcome.
Madam Chair, my name is Jim Nass. I serve as legal counsel for the appellate courts. A motion for judgment notwithstanding the verdict or a motion for a new trial is directed to the trial court, and the trial court is the only entity with the authority to rule on it. What happens when somebody jumps the gun and files a notice of appeal during that 55-day period that the trial court has to rule on the motion, that deprives the trial court of jurisdiction to rule on the motion. Mm-hmm. At the same time, the filing of the motion itself rendered the judgment non-appealable. So we're in this kind of a standoff. The trial court can't rule on the motion. We can't go forward with the appeal. What we're having to do now is that we ultimately dismiss the appeal, wait for the appellate judgment to issue, then that 55-day clock starts to run again. And so what parties have to do is figure, okay, I filed my motion on X date. Notice of appeal was filed, let's say, as often happens, the notice of appeal often is filed close to the 30th day. So let's say that it's filed on the 25th day. It takes us a couple months to dismiss the case. We issue the appellate judgment. It goes back to the trial court. That 55 days has 25 days taken out of it. So that there's 30 days left for the trial court to rule on the motion. That's if everything has gone sort of okay. What oftentimes happens is that the trial court goes ahead and issues an order purporting to decide this motion. It didn't have a jurisdiction to do so, but the parties didn't recognize that. So we end up with this huge morass of timing problems, all of which can be solved by merely saying that the trial court retains jurisdiction to rule on these motions. Then we don't have to worry about this clock starting and stopping. We don't have to worry about somebody jumping the gun and filing a notice of appeal, depriving the trial court of jurisdiction. And worst case, if someone should file a notice of appeal within the first 10 days after entry of judgment, depriving a party of even the opportunity to file a motion for a new trial or motion for judgment, notwithstanding the verdict.
Okay, Senator Pruszynski.
Yep, Madam Chair, I mean, looking at the bill, if you can see that there's already two provisions already in place to allow the trial court to maintain mm-hmm. jurisdiction over the case. That's the A and B, lines 9 and line 11. So if we adopt this bill, the other three would be included. So now the trial court would have jurisdiction for five specific reasons, as the good senator from Douglas County would say. They're using their common sense and allowing the trial court to maintain jurisdiction for those limited purposes, so we don't end up having basically gridlock in the court system that requires all this backwards and a lot of time and energy to really get the case back to the point where the trial court can do what it should be doing, because you had someone that jumped the gun in filing the notice for appeal.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Senator Barr.
Thank you. The person who's jumping the gun, is that, I mean, I would assume both parties are represented by an attorney, and the attorney should know the rules. So is the person who's jumping the gun and filing the appeals at the wrong time, are they just trying to get more billable hours against their clients, or what? Why are they doing it?
Chair Burdick, Senator Beyer, it in most instances is a function of trying to be extra cautious, because the rules are not particularly clear with respect to judgments notwithstanding the verdict and motions for new trial and motions for correcting a judgment. Many attorneys out there, without specifically knowing the practice, and because the rule and statutes are not particularly clear with respect to who has jurisdiction, would go ahead and file a petition for appeal to protect their client's interests. Certainly, retrospectively, it creates more of a problem than it solves. And what this bill is attempting to do is make sure that everybody knows from here on out that jurisdiction stays with the court. Now, with respect to the issue of billing more hours, I think what happens is that I think that the result of not having had this amendment corrected, or this legislation corrected in the past, is that it has not only created a lot of extra time expended to set the record straight and get people back on track, but it has cost people the cost of refiling a petition for appeal. And to the extent that individual practitioners may or may not bill for that time, especially the person jumping the gun, that's an individual consideration. Now, the opposing party, unfortunately, may have to contend with billing more time, even when they weren't the ones involved in jumping the gun. But what this does is eliminates the possibility of additional billable hours or billing for things that didn't have to happen.
Madam Chair, if I might speak to that.
Please.
Question. Briefly, about a third of all of our cases, one or both parties are not represented by counsel. There are a lot of people who choose not to be represented by counsel, and oftentimes they are not aware of the rules and are not aware of what the consequences are when they jump the gun. The other thing that can happen is that you can have multi-party litigation. You have one party who wants to file a motion for a new trial, another party who wants to go forward with the appeal, and they're not talking to each other, or they don't realize what the effect these two things have on each other.
Thank you.
So this would clarify everything, so everybody would know what to do. Okay. All right. Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Close public hearing on House Bill 2368. Open a work session on House Bill 2368. Senator Barr.
House Bill 2368 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Barr, House Bill 2368 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Pruszynski, maybe you'd like to carry this one. Okay. Any other business before the committee? Seeing none. Senate Judiciary is adjourned.